Welcome back to Book Therapy. This is Rob Cohen. This is episode lucky number 13, and I have a question for you. Have you ever heard of the author by the name of Wilkie Collins? That's W-I-L-K-I-E-C-O-L-L-I-N-S. Well, I'd never heard of him either. And if you have, well, then maybe you're much better read than I am, because I'd never heard of him up to a couple of years ago. And the only reason why I'd heard of him was because I read a book I mentioned, I think, on the last episode called Drood by Dan Simmons, Drood, D-R-O-D. And the reason why I picked that book up was I'd seen it in the bookstore and was aware of The Mystery of Edwin Drood, the unfinished mystery novel by Charles Dickens. And I'd seen the musical on Broadway, didn't know too much about the book, saw this book on the stands, decided to pick it up, and seemed intriguing enough, and so I just started to read it. It was really an interesting book, suspenseful, dramatic, creepy, but it was told as a first-person account, told by this character by the name of Wilkie Collins. And at the time as I was reading that book, I believed that Wilkie Collins was an entirely fictional character, that Dan Simmons had made him up in order to tell this story. And it was only as I read further into the book and learned a little bit more about Wilkie Collins that I discovered that he was actually a real person, was a real author, and in fact was a pretty substantial author at the time of Charles Dickens. He was one of Charles Dickens' best friends. He and Charles Dickens actually concocted the idea of writing a detective novel, or each of them discussed writing a detective novel, and Wilkie Collins wrote his. Dickens didn't get through his. He had died before The Mystery of Edwin Drood was completed. But I was surprised that there was this author from the 1850s, 1860s, who was as popular as Wilkie Collins was, and yet I didn't know about him, because Charles Dickens was much more popular as time went on. His books seem to have stood the test of time and are studied in high schools and colleges around the world, and yet Wilkie Collins, for whatever reason, seemed to have passed by my notice. But as part of my renewed interest in the classics and in some of the older books, I picked up The Moonstone, which was Wilkie Collins' detective novel. I picked it up last year, and I read it just about last year at this time. And interestingly enough, it is regarded as the first, the longest, and probably the finest detective novel ever written. And one of the genres of literature that I particularly enjoy are detective novels, whether they be police procedurals or Private Eyes or any other type of a mystery. Those are the types of books that I really tend to enjoy most. So the fact that this was widely regarded as the first and the finest detective novel ever written, it was reason enough to read it. And so I read it last year, and I enjoyed it. I thought that it was a little bit too long. Some of the story structure was incredibly affecting from the standpoint of it being told from numerous points of view. In fact, the closest analogy I can give to the method by which it was told was a movie that came out 4 or 5 years ago with Dennis Quaid called Vantage Point. And if you've seen Vantage Point, it's a movie that depicts the same event from numerous different perspectives. So you've got, I think it was an assassination or an assassination attempt in a third world country. And you have the various characters who all were at different places while the incident was taking place. And so the movie shows you each of those characters and what they were doing when the assassination attempt took place. The Moonstone is basically told in that same style. It involves this moonstone, a precious gem, which was brought back to London from India at a time when India was an English colony. And this moonstone gets delivered to a woman. And while all these people are at the woman's house, she's planning for a wedding, I think is what the circumstances were, the moonstone goes missing. And all of the participants in the story were people who were present at the time the moonstone went missing. So it includes the visitors to the house. It includes service people, you know, the maid staff, the wait staff, the butler, I think has a pretty lengthy narrative at one point. And also, and I think what was the first instance or the first appearance of a character such as this, an actual police detective who has equally a large portion of the book is his narrative. So it was an interesting book. It wasn't my favorite. I liked it. I certainly felt that it was worth reading from the standpoint of my love of detective fiction from the current day. But I really enjoyed it, and I was interested to see what other Wilkie Collins books were out there. Now, it turns out that there was another book that Wilkie Collins had written, which seems to have stood the test of time. I believe he wrote something like 20 or 25 other novels, but for whatever reason, The Moonstone and then this other book are the only two that seem to have really lasted. I don't know why. I have my ideas. We'll talk about those a little bit later. But this other book was called The Woman in White, and I think it was published before The Moonstone. And it wasn't a detective novel, obviously The Moonstone being the first, although I think the way that I would categorize it would be a thriller or a novel of suspense. But consider a novel of suspense as you might think of it today, like The Silence of the Lambs, or even a Jack Reacher book might be a suspense book, or anything like that, where you get the feeling that the intensity is palpable, that time is of the essence, and the pages flip by because of the tension that's created by the writing. This is not by any means quite the page turner the way those books are. This one is much longer than The Moonstone. I think The Moonstone was only about less than 500 pages. The Woman in White was 620 pages long. But definitely a thriller, definitely suspense. When I saw The Woman in White in the bookstore, I'd seen it maybe a year or so ago after I'd picked up The Moonstone. I hadn't read it yet, but I was still interested in Wilkie Collins. And when I saw that the book was called The Woman in White, it reminded me of a musical that Andrew Lloyd Webber had done, which was, I don't think it was on Broadway, but I know it was in London. I spent a lot of time in London at various points in my life. One summer during law school, I spent 6 weeks there. And it's truly one of my favorite cities. And I've been back three or four times since then. So over the past 13 years. And I think at one point when I was there, I noticed that this musical by Andrew Lloyd Webber called The Woman in White was playing on the, I think it's in the West End. And I didn't see the musical. I remember some of the posters for the musical. And I think that it gave off the perception that it was a ghost story. I think that the terminology that was used on the posters was it was a haunting musical or something like that. So I had the belief that it was something that was probably scary. And as I mentioned before, I'm not big on scary books. I don't really like anything that will give me nightmares. And I was worried that The Woman in White would be scary. And so I picked it up and put it down on numerous occasions. And then as time had gone on and I read The Moonstone and I enjoyed it, I did a little bit more research on The Woman in White and got the feeling that it was less a ghost story than it was something like a gothic mystery. And as you know, I've tried lately to find books that were of that type of genre. We're talking mid to late 1860s, we're talking London, we're talking cobblestone streets and things like that, where, the fog coming, rolling in. And when I'd heard The Woman in White referred to as a gothic mystery or a gothic novel, I figured, well, maybe as The Moonstone was a precursor to some of the other detective novels, all the detective novels that have come after, maybe The Woman in White was a precursor for the gothic novels that have since, certainly gained more prominence lately. So I picked it up, not really knowing what to expect. I knew that it was going to be a lengthy endeavor because of its size. And now the version that I read is the Barnes & Noble Classics version. And I think that as these books are now long since in the public domain, anybody can publish them. And so you'll see different sized books. You'll see hardcover. You'll see paperback. You'll see harder, big paperback books or whatever you mass markets, however they're defined at this point. And I read David Copperfield of the same, by Charles Dickens, obviously. I read that in the same publishing, the Barnes & Noble Classics. And I think when I read it, it was long. The pages seemed long. the words felt, the print was small. And so I've had this book for a while. And I knew it really was going to require an effort to get through it, and I had to be in the right mindset as to when I wanted to read it. So finally got in the mindset. But first off, the book itself, the actual printing of it, I don't know what it is, but if you go in the bookstore and you see these classic novels on the shelves, it always seems like they got the ugliest covers. Like they've got some painting or drawing or piece of artwork which is designed to make it look like it's from olden times, and yet it seems to have nothing to do with the book. And this one, you know, hopefully maybe you'll go to Amazon or whatever and you'll look at Barnes & Noble probably, and you'll look for this version of the book, because it's got a lady on the front, and it looks like she's wearing a clown outfit. And I know it's not a clown outfit. It's white-ish. It's not white. It's white-ish, and I think part of it looks pink, and seems to be pretty ugly. It makes no sense to me. I just don't get it. It's not a book that you look and go, oh, that looks like an interesting book just based on the cover. So, you know, whoever the marketing people are who are putting these things out, I think they need to maybe reconsider their book art. Now, one of the other things that I don't like about the classics, and it has nothing to do with the content of the books themselves, the actual content written by the classic author, it's the way that they're printed from the standpoint of the use of scholars who frequently write introductions or footnotes. This book has an introduction by some sort of a scholar, and it has footnotes, and it has endnotes. And the endnotes, I didn't really pay much attention to. The footnotes were actually pretty helpful. The introduction, okay, I gotta tell this story, because the thing with the classics is it just seems to me as if the publishers of the classics assume that if you're picking it up, you already know the story, and you're reading it because you want to read it again, or you're reading it for a class, or whatever it is. They don't seem to take into consideration the fact that it could be somebody who's never read it before, doesn't know the story, and really wants to be surprised by what's contained in it. And I had a situation when I picked up Oliver Twist, I think it was, where I read the introduction, because I'm the kind of person who reads from the beginning to the end, and I don't want to miss anything. And it's hard at times to decipher what's important and what's not. Now, I think that some of Dickens' books, there, and in fact, I'll mention in this one, The Woman in White, there are prefaces. There's a preface written in 1860 and a preface written in 1861, and they're both by the author. They're both by Wilkie Collins. So those to me seem to be important pieces to read prior to actually reading the book, because if they're written at that time, then the author had a reason for wanting this to be included as a preface. The introductions, though, seem to me to be the scholar attempting to demonstrate how smart they are, and perhaps giving the reader a bit of a reading guide. Which is fine if you're not reading it for the purpose of pleasure. If you're reading it for the purpose of study, or you're reading it for a class where you're going to be tested on it, or there's some great discussion that's going to be held about the interpretation of it, then read the introduction, go ahead. But for those of us who like to read the book just to read the book, I don't have any ulterior motives for reading the book. I'm not getting tested on this. I'm not going to write any theses on it or anything like that. I don't really need the introduction. But the naive reader, of which I was when I read Oliver Twist, I don't know that. And so when I read Oliver Twist, and the only experience I had with Oliver Twist was the musical, and I know that the musical, the movie, I didn't see it on stage, I saw the movies, we all did at some point. I really don't remember anything that happens after Oliver leaves the orphanage. It seems to be muddled. I don't really remember so much. So the story of Oliver Twist is truly brand new to me, and so I was a blank slate. But I read the introduction first, and wouldn't you know that it gives everything away. And there's not a whole lot of drama to Oliver Twist from the standpoint of surprises, but there's a murder, and there's Bill Sykes, and there's Fagin, and I think Fagin kills Bill Sykes, or I don't remember, somebody dies, and I think the woman dies. I mean, there's a lot to it that you don't remember from the musical, and that I certainly would not have remembered or had any preconceived expectations of had I not read the introduction. So from that standpoint, my recommendation to whoever's publishing these books is don't make it an introduction, make it a closing, make it an afterword. I don't care, but don't put it at the front, because you're going to get some poor author, some poor guy like me, not author, some poor reader who thinks book needs to be read from beginning to the end, and that means start at the beginning and read everything forward, and you're going to give stuff away. As it is with The Woman in White, I did not read the introduction. In fact, I haven't read it yet. And I don't really know if I need to. I don't know that it has any particular appeal to me, because I thought that I got as much out of the book as I needed to get. I had mentioned this to before in one of the previous podcasts, where I said that I believe that this might be the best book I ever read. I've got to best book or favorite book. I don't remember what terminology I use, but both of them are incorrect, and they're incorrect because I don't have a favorite book. I don't know that I can put my finger on the best book I've ever read, and the reason why I think that is because I don't read books more than once. I can tell you what my favorite song is. I can tell you what my favorite movie is. I can even tell you probably what my favorite TV show was or what my favorite TV show episode is. And the reason why is because I've had the opportunity to rewatch those or re-listen to the songs. And that's the way that I can show my affection for that type of a media, is to continue to watch or to continue to experience it. My favorite movie is Die Hard. And the way that I can demonstrate that is I've seen it multiples of times, and anytime it's on television, I stop and watch it. And it's always new to me. It's always exciting. Even though I've seen it as many times as I have, it's still the most fun experience, or it's really the movie that resonates with me the most, where I get the most excited about it. I don't have that same relationship with books because I don't reread books. I could probably tell you that if there were any books that I would label as my favorites, it doesn't mean that I would ever want to read them again. Because to me, reading a book more than once is, I don't do it. I mentioned before, I just don't like to do it. And so I can't say I wouldn't be able to answer a question, what's your favorite book you've ever read? I couldn't tell you that. So what I will do instead of saying my favorite book or the best book, I'm going to describe it in terms of this. This book, The Woman in White, is amongst the most enjoyable reading experiences that I've ever had. And that's the way that I'll demonstrate my high level of satisfaction for this book. Satisfaction may even be too pedantic of a term. The high level of excitement that I had for this book, the high level of enjoyment that I had for this book, the high level of affection that I had for this book. And when I think about books that, if somebody were to say, what was the most enjoyable reading experience that you can recall, I would definitely put The Woman in White. And there are a couple other books I would select. And they may be off the beaten path as far as you may be concerned. I can tell you that I am a big fan of the Tom Clancy novels, and of all the Jack Ryan books and all the non-Jack Ryan books that I've read, the one that I would consider to be the most enjoyable reading experience amongst all of them was a book called Executive Orders. And that was what I know a lot of people consider to be fairly weak or overblown. Certainly it was one of the longest books that Tom Clancy had written. I think it was 1,100 or 1,200 pages. But when I think back to that series of books, or when I think back to the complexities of the story, I come back to the enjoyment that I had when reading the book. That's the one that certainly does stand out to me. Hey, we like what we like. We enjoy what we enjoy. But The Woman in White, I really, really enjoyed this book. It was a incredibly pleasurable reading experience. And it's one that I don't know that everybody could actually experience. I don't know that a lot of people out there would enjoy it, because it is slow. It really requires attention. I found myself at times my mind wandering, and I'd have to reread things. But whereas the Dickens novels are enjoyable reading experiences, but they are lengthy and they are troublesome at times to get through. The language is complex and at times very confusing. The Woman in White wasn't like that. And for the fact that the books were written, the Woman in White was written at the exact same time that Dickens was writing his novels, it's surprising to me how the writing styles were so incredibly different. Wilkie Collins writes like he's talking to his friend. Yeah, there's a little bit of haughtyism because of the story. He does seem to adopt a little bit of a snotty type of terminology at times, like the upper class would speak. But I think he does that for the standpoint because it's necessary to the story. So to get a little bit further into it, let me give you a little bit about what the story is, and I'll tell you straight out that the musical that portrayed it as haunting and a ghost story, the book was nothing like that. And after I'd finished the book, I actually did more research on the musical, and I read some synopsis of it. I watched some of the clips online of the scenes from the movie. And it seems like other than the names of the characters and the mysterious woman in white, I think that the stories were pretty much different to a T. So no ghosts, no, well, at least I hope they weren't ghosts. I don't think there were ghosts. If there were ghosts there, then I missed something. but no horror, no haunting, no ghosts, but definitely suspenseful, definitely a thriller, but it was a slow burn. Not the 350-page thriller that you stay up late at night wanting to get to the next page because you can't wait to see what happens. This one was definitely a slow reveal. But so the story is there's an artist, an art teacher by the name of Walter Hartwright, and he gets a job as a private art teacher on this nice estate outside of London, where there's the owner of the house who is constantly sick and stays in his room all the time and complains about everything. But it's his two of they're not his daughters, one of his niece and a step niece, I think is what they are, and their names are Laura and Marion. And so Walter Hartwright comes to this estate, and he is there for a period of time where he is teaching art to these two ladies. Well, on the night before he's due to depart London to go to this estate, he is walking around London contemplating his life and the fact that he's reached kind of a dead end to his life, so now he has to take this job as an art teacher for what he thinks will be two upper-class snotty women teaching him art. He comes upon a woman in white who seems to be wandering aimlessly, and we don't get a whole lot of information from him during the initial encounter, but he is a soul who seems to be wanting to help, and so he goes to the woman and he offers to help her because it's late at night and she's all alone. And she starts rambling a little bit about the town that this estate is in, and he says, well, I happen to be going there tomorrow, and what can you tell me about it? And she says, well, you know, there's this guy there, and he's really a bad, bad person. He's really a bad, 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 bad person. Stay away from him. Stay away from him. Well, he says, okay, great, thanks. He gets her into a cab, and off she goes. Well, after she drives away, two guys come up and say, have you seen this woman in white? And Hartwright says, well, yeah, she just went into a cab. What's the big deal? Well, these two gentlemen inform him that she had just escaped from the mental institution, from the asylum. Well, that puts Mr. Hartwright a little bit ill at ease, but he's got nothing else to do, so there's nothing else he can do about it, so he goes back home and the next day reports for work. So he goes to this estate and he's helping these two women, and one of them is described as incredibly ugly. She is just not appealing at all. She's one of the women who you get the feeling will always be a bachelorette. That's not the right term. She's never going to get married. But the other one, Laura, the ugly one is Marion. And Collins does an incredible job of describing her as how ugly she is. But that doesn't mean she's bad. So, I mean, she's actually a wonderful, wonderful character. And the other one, their stepsisters, is Laura. And Laura is beautiful, and everything that's bad about or ugly about Marion is beautiful about Laura. So obviously, as the time goes by, our good dear Mr. Hartwright falls in love with Laura. And Laura, interestingly enough, starts to fall in love with him, with Hartwright. But Laura is already betrothed to another man. And this was a marriage that was arranged a long time previous. Well, it turns out, wouldn't you know, that the man to whom Laura is engaged just happens to be, his name is Percival, and he's a lord, I think, is no, a baronet. It just happens to be the exact same man that the woman in white had warned Hartwright about. And I think that the woman in white referred to him as a baronet, which is how Hartwright figured out that it was the same person. Did he figure it out? You know, I don't think he figured it out just then. You know, I don't remember. It's really not important when he figured it out. But nevertheless, he realizes that he'll never have Laura, because Laura is betrothed to another man, and he simply cannot stay there any longer. And so he begs to be let out of his contract so that he can go home. And in fact, he doesn't go home, so he can get as far away from Laura as possible, as far away from the love of his life as possible, so he can get rid of his sorrows. And he actually takes a I think he gets a job on a ship that goes to South America and does some exploration in South America or something like that. So he goes away, and so his story ends, and now the story of the marriage of Percival and Laura begins. And from that standpoint, I don't really want to give you too much more of the story from there, because suffice it to say that everything that the woman in white said about Percy is true. And in fact, the woman in white is trying to save Laura by trying to help her. The woman in white shows up every once in a while. The woman in white sent a handwritten letter to Laura saying, don't get married to him, don't get married to him. And while Laura is trying to track down the woman in white to find out more and learn why the woman in white is so afraid of Percival and why she has such detestable feelings for him, Percival, in fact, is trying to find the woman in white as well, because he wants to shut her up. And the belief is that the woman in white has some sort of a secret, and she knows something about Percival that if the secret were divulged, it could destroy Percival's life. So that's the turmoil between Laura and Percival. What we later find out is that Percival is in poor financial condition, and yet Laura is in better financial condition, that she stands to inherit a lot of money, and in fact, upon the marriage, she was guaranteed to inherit a whole lot of money. And so Percival is trying to get Laura to agree to give him money, and Laura is refusing. And all the while, Marion, the half-sister, stepsister, half-sister, is there watching over Laura and trying to take care of her, because Laura is fairly meek, she's weak, she's very fragile, whereas Marion is 180 degrees the opposite. She is strong, she is incredibly intelligent, and she is very, very bright, and she sees through things. She has a keen eye for personalities of people. She knows who's good and she knows who's bad, and she really she can figure out a person's character very, very well. And she and Hartwright actually had a very strong relationship as friends, because Marion understood that that Hartwright was in love with Laura. I don't want to give too much away. I really don't want to give too much away. There's a character who comes to stay at the estate with Percival, a good friend of Percival's. His name is Count Fosco, F-O-S-C-O. And this guy is truly a character, just a well-created caricature of the ebullient and larger-than-life personality of an Italian count, who has weird idiosyncrasies involving mice and involving birds, and has some sort of a weird affection for Mary, and where he finds her just truly engaging, and at times it seems like he's falling in love with her, but he's got a wife of his own who seems to be real mysterious. She's got some strange goings on all about herself. But it's this Count Fosco character who really kind of controls a lot of the story, because Marion just doesn't trust him. There's something wrong about him. There's something off about him. And he comes off as incredibly charming, but Marion can see through him, and there's a mystery to him, and there's a story about him. And the relationship between he and Percival, and Count Fosco seems to have the ability to control Percival. So when Percival asks Laura for money and she refuses, and Percival goes off the deep end and starts yelling at her, somehow or other, Count Fosco is able to calm him down and takes him aside and is able to whisper, you know, to calm him down, that there's better ways to get things done. And just a truly remarkable, remarkable character. And in fact, there's an element to him that is real creepy, because you don't know what his story is. You don't know what the deal is about him. And you believe from Marion that, well, let me tell you about the story, the structure of the story, so you get an idea of how it's put together. So when I say that Marion says this or Harriet says that, you understand why. The book is told from numerous different standpoints, similar to the Moonstone. The Moonstone, as I mentioned, was told from different perspectives, all people portraying their recollections of the same event. This is different, from the standpoint that it's not everybody telling the same story from different perspectives. This is a truly linear story from beginning to end, but different narrators pick up the story at different places. So the beginning portion of the story is told by Walter Hartwright, and it's his experiences with the woman in white, and then his experience at the estate, and then it goes up to the point where he leaves the estate and goes off to South America. From then, Marion takes over, and it's her diary entries. And so her diary entries, as she chronicles everything from the point that Hartwright left until a certain other event takes place. And all told, there's 11 different voices that you hear from during the story. You get an aspect of it from Laura's attorney. You get a portion of it from Laura's uncle, who's the recluse who's always complaining, who's always, I think he's hypochondriac, actually. There's a portion of it from him. And then there's another portion from Marion again. And then there's another portion from Hartwright again. And then there's a portion from a doctor. And there's a portion from a housekeeper, or a Laura's handmaiden, or however it's termed, lady-in-waiting. I don't know what the right terminology is. So all these different characters are telling the story. And you understand that at some point you get to the end of the story with Hartwright, where he tells you when he got these different people to tell these stories. So you understand that it was put together at the end as a cohesive story, so it was told in a linear fashion as the characters were experiencing the events. That's not when they were simultaneously writing these things down. Hartwright actually tells you that he went to various of the characters and said, and this is the point where I asked so-and-so to write their narrative. So you understand how the story was put together. But it's really affecting, it's really effective, because it tells a story in a linear fashion. So it is from beginning to end. There's no jumping back and forth like in the Moonstone, where you have jumping back and forth because you have the story now restarting from a different perspective. It's told straightforward, but you get the different voices, and you see as one character departs the scene, the other one stays and now continues the story. And it's really interesting. And it works so incredibly well. And I have to tell you this one portion of the book, one scene, which if I were reading this at the time when it was published, so if you can remember from your literature studies, the novels that were written in the time of Dickens and Wilkie Collins, they were not published as books. They were serialized. So you would get a chapter or two or however many, whatever the length of the project was, you get a disbursement from the magazine or the published whatever it was, and then you'd read it and you'd have to wait until the next installment came out. And there's some aspects of The Woman in White which are so incredibly suspenseful that I can only imagine having read it at that time and having a cliffhanger, so to speak, hit, and then having to wait what could have been, I don't even know how long, for the next thing to happen, you know, for the next installment. So At the the second portion of the book is the diary of Marion Holcomb. Her last name is Holcomb, and it's her entry. So she gives you the dates on when things happen, and she describes every day what happened and how the story was unfolding. And when Count Fosco shows up, Marion has some very specific feelings about her about him, and she really distrusts him, and she is not in any way shy about expressing how she feels about him. And she says, I don't like him, I don't trust him, he is icky, you know, not icky, but she uses she gives a lot of attention to the description of Count Fosco as a way for the reader to understand just how dastardly this guy is. But we don't know that. This is just Marion's, this is just Marion's feeling about it. This is her perception on it. And so Marion's story actually comprises a good, it looks to be about 170 pages. The second, that comprises the first half. So the second half of the first half, whatever it is. It's 170 pages of her narrative from her diaries. And you track the story. And at the end of her diary, she gets really sick. Now, part of it was, or you're led to believe that the reason why she got sick was because she had been, interesting, if you can picture a woman from 1860, you know, prim and proper upper class English woman, you know, with all the petticoats or whatever kind of clothing they wore. And this is so you get a good feel about Mary. And she's actually climbing on the roof and sitting on an eave over where Count Fosco and Percival are talking, so she can eavesdrop on their conversation. And it's fascinating. You can picture this happening, but you get the feel of how strong Marion really is, and to the lengths that she would go to protect Laura. And she absolutely dotes on Laura, loves Laura immensely. But so after this installment, after this situation where she's climbing on the eaves, and it turns out that as she's sitting there, it's raining and it's getting cold. She comes down sick, and the diary ends with her talking about how sick she feels. And she says, "I'm sadly afraid of my head. I can write, but the lines all run together. I see the words. I'm so cold. The rain last night. The strokes of the clock keep striking in my head," and then it ends. And I can only imagine reading this in an installation back then, because there's a note that appears after this abrupt ending to the diary. And it says, "At this place, the entry in the diary ceases to be legible. The two or three lines which follow contain fragments of words only, mingled with blots and scratches of the pen. The last marks on the paper bear some resemblance to the first two letters L and A of the name of Laura." But it then says, "On the next page of the diary, another entry appears. It is in a man's handwriting, large, bold, and firmly regular. And it contains these lines." And it says, "It's a postscript by a sincere friend. And it's written by Count Fosco." And Count Fosco tells you that he read the entire diary. He knows everything that Marion said about him. He knows everything that Marion suspects of him. And he tells you that he knows this. And we know that Marion's sick, and we don't know what's going to happen to her. And I'm actually, it's weird, I'm getting chills right now as I'm talking about it, because it's just so dramatic. And Count Fosco tells you he knows what she thought of him. And he doesn't tell you what happened to Marion. He doesn't tell you whether she lives or dies. And he doesn't tell you whether the source of her sickness is from being out in the rain, or whether she's been poisoned. He doesn't tell you, but he does tell you that he knows. And can you imagine, you're watching a movie, and you're watching from a bird's eye view what a character does, and you feel like you're the only one privy to this information, like that nobody else is around. You've got the best seat in the house because you're seeing all the bad things are going on. And then as the story comes to an end, the bad guy you've been watching comes directly to you, looks you right in the eye, and says, I knew you were there all along, and I know that you watched me. I mean, it's just creepy. It's creepy, and you don't know about this guy. You don't know about Count Fosco. You don't know what his motives are, and you don't know what he's doing there, and you don't know if he's good or bad. And interestingly enough, after the narrative by Marion, there's a narrative by a character named Eliza Michelson, who's the housekeeper at the estate, and she was totally taken in by Count Fosco. She thought Count Fosco was just the nicest man, the perfect gentleman. Who could ever and she doesn't say it this way, but she certainly gives out the impression that she believes that Count Fosco is a man among men. He's the most trustworthy, the most amiable, certainly the most gentleman of gentlemen. And she would never think anything ill about Count Fosco. And yet we already know that Marion thinks that he's one of the true, true bad guys. So when you see this from Count Fosco, you just, it's chilling. It really is chilling. And again, it's not chilling the same way that The Silence of the Lambs is chilling. It's not chilling the way Presumed Innocent is chilling. But from the standards of the 1860s, when you compare it with Our Mutual Friend or David Copperfield, this is chilling, chilling stuff. And it's really suspenseful. And once you finish with Marion's narrative, it's a good long time before you find out what happened to her. And so that keeps the suspense, it keeps the tension, and you feel a little bit hamstrung at times by the writing, because you know that if it were written in today's society, that it wouldn't be this drawn out. It wouldn't be this slow burn like I described earlier. You know that it would be resolved in a much quicker time frame, but it's still so so effective and completely different from anything that we would see that Dickens would do. And in fact, I read The Mystery of Edwin Drood, or I read the half of it that that Dickens had written before he died, and it is nowhere near the level of suspense or intrigue that The Moonstone was, or that A Woman in White was. I think it was a demonstration of a couple things. One, I think that Dickens was really sick when he wrote it. I think that he was on drugs. And interestingly enough, Wilkie Collins was a noted drug user, very addicted to laudanum. And that was actually another reason why I was a little bit reticent about reading The Woman in White, because I was kind of worried that it was going to be rambling garbage. I didn't know what to expect from a person who was that dependent upon drugs. When I read Drood, and it gave a little bit of drama or dramatized some of Collins's laudanum episodes, it seemed like some pretty far out stuff. So I was concerned or reticent that The Woman in White would be the ramblings of a drug-induced loon. But going back to Dickens, the Mystery of Edwin Drood, the mystery novel was not Dickens' forte, and I believe that if he had completed the novel, it would have been a letdown, and I don't know that he would have had any success if he wrote any others. It's one of the more forgettable of Dickens' novels. But going back to The Woman in White, I don't want to tell you how it ends. The mystery of The Woman in White is certainly revealed. The mystery of the secret that is Percival's secret is revealed. How this book compares with The Moonstone as it relates to this mystery aspect, because The Moonstone was a straight detective novel which had a mystery and had a resolution at the end which resolved the mystery. The Woman in White was more of a thriller, so there was a mystery aspect to it, that mystery being who's the woman in white, what's her connection to Percival, and what's this secret that Percival has. The reveal of the secret that Percival had was not great. But then when you consider it in the context of the time in which the book was written, you realize that the secret actually was a pretty it was a big secret, and one that society in the 1860s would have found to be incredibly important. So whereas our society now would look at that type of a secret as being okay, it doesn't really have much of an impact on us, in the time in which the book was written, I can imagine that the reveal as it came to the reading population would have had a distinct impact on the readers, that they would have truly been appalled by the secret. So I'm not going to hold the book, or I'm not going to detract or take points away from the book because the secret to me wasn't particularly dramatic, because I don't know that the secret itself, the reveal of the secret, was really what drove the book. The book was not driven by the secret that Percival was keeping. The book was driven by the mystery of the woman in white, who she was, the mystery of who Count Fosco was, and how all the characters were going to get out of it. How was it going to be resolved? That was the question. Was there going to be an everybody lives happily ever after? Or how were the bad guys going to get it? And who were the bad guys? So that was what I felt drove the book, much less so the secret that that Percival had, that he believed the woman in white was privy to. So there's a couple of passages I want to read to you, just because I thought that they were just the writing was so wonderful. And I didn't, as I read these books, I take notes. Because it's such a lengthy book, I didn't pull out passages from each page, even though there were so many noteworthy passages that I just really enjoyed. And I did this also, or I note this when I'm reading Dickens, that there's such a mastery of the English language that some of the passages are just so beautiful they require a review or reread or something like that, or certainly the things that I want to share. These passages that I'm going to read you, it wasn't that they were so on the scale of a Dickens or so impactful as that. I just found them to be funny. Wilkie Collins truly has a sense of humor. And at one point, he's talking about children. And he says, I sadly want a reform in the construction of children. Nature's only idea seems to be to make them machines for the production of incessant noise. Oh, that's pretty funny, because I got two kids, and it seems like all they're doing is making noise. And this was 1860, and he says, what good are children? It seems like they're only put on this earth to make noise. I just thought that was I thought it was funny. Another passage, and this will be the last passage I share with you, he was talking about an old lady who was at the estate, and she didn't do anything. The way that I pictured her, if you've seen the movie Murder by Death, which is a terrific, terrific movie. There's a character who is a takeoff on Miss Marple's, one of the characters from Agatha Christie novels. And her character in this movie, Murder by Death, is Jessica Marbles. So to quickly get through Murder by Death, it's it's basically the precursor to the movie Clue, where all of these people are summoned to a house to solve a murder. But all of the characters are based on real literary mystery figures. So you've got characters that are based on the Nick and Nora Charles from the Thin Man series. Their characters are Dick and Dora Charleston. You have Jessica Marbles, which is based on the Jessica Marbles from the Agatha Christie. You've got a character who's based on Hercule Poirot from the Agatha Christie novels. I don't remember what his name was, but it was a French guy. You have a character that's based on Sam Spade from Dashiell Hammett. Dashiell Hammett was Sam Spade? I think it was. The Big Sleep. Not Dashiell Hammett. Crap, why am I... I can't remember. Anyways, it wasn't Sam Spade, it was Sam Diamond. And instead of Charlie Chan, it was Sidney Chow. So all these characters... the Jessica Marbles character, she comes with her nurse. But her nurse is this old lady who sits in a wheelchair, seems to be drooling, doesn't say anything other than fart. I think she farts, I recall. But that's all that the character does. And that was the way that I pictured this character that Wilkie Collins is describing. Her name is Mrs. Vesey. And how she describes her is a mild, a compliant, an unutterably tranquil and harmless old lady who never by any chance suggested the idea that she had been actually alive since the hour of her birth. I mean, it's just, it's fascinating. It is fascinating. This is just, Nature was absorbed in making cabbages when Mrs. Vesey was born, and the good lady suffered the consequences of a vegetable preoccupation in the mind of the mother of us all. It's hysterical. I mean, it's not comedic that we would find funny from, any of the modern day comics, but when you think about, literature in the 1860s, and you think about a character that's being compared with a vegetable, it's just hysterical. I found myself laughing out loud at some points, and you don't necessarily always expect to be laughing out loud when you're reading a Barnes & Noble classics. Now, one of the other ways that that Collins created this suspense, and again, this slow reveal of the story, was he had his female characters enveloped in the customs of the time. So they're not individuals. They're not independent. They're bound by the strictures of society and what society expects of them. So that subservience that is engendered in the women creates a claustrophobia, which then creates this tension. There's one scene when Marion is worried about what's happening with Laura, and Count Fosco's wife actually disappears, and Marion is wondering what Count Fosco's wife is doing, going to, pursue Laura, and God knows what she's going to do. But Count Fosco needs her, and Count Fosco is playing the piano and continues to ask Marion what she thinks about his piano playing, and her decorum for society and for what was expected of women in society means that she can't leave. She can't just say, oh, I've got to go. And at times she says, I'm feeling tired, I need to leave, and Count Fosco still finds ways to keep her there. And it creates this claustrophobia that we don't know what's going on. We, as the reader, don't know, because Marion is telling us this as her diary entry. And I wanted to leave, but Count Fosco wouldn't let me leave. And he kept asking me what I thought about his piano playing. And I couldn't leave. I couldn't get out. I couldn't go help my sister. And all the while, we're sitting there thinking, well, shit, what the hell happened? Tell us what happened. But Marion doesn't know because she's stuck in the piano room. Really, really a effective use of the society's expectations and the gender roles to create this suspense. There's another aspect of the story which I wanted to share with you. It has nothing to do with the story itself, but the method by which Wilkie Collins tells the story, because truly he tells it as if he's telling the story to his friend, because he seems to anticipate what the reader is thinking. And in fact, there's a part where, and it's way towards the end of the book, it's on page 556, where it's back to the narration of Walter Hartwright. So he's back in the story, and he's trying to figure out a way to trap Count Fosco or determine what Count Fosco's angle is. And he realizes that he has a friend who might know him. Well, this is a friend that we haven't seen in 534 pages. The last time that this friend showed up was on page 22. And in fact, it was this friend who got Hartwright the job at the estate in the first place. But he says, oh, I know who I can call to. It's my quaint little friend is what he calls him, Professor Pesca. And then there's a break. There's a break in the paragraph, so it's a section break in the middle of the chapter. And you're reading it going, Professor Pesca, I remember that name. Where do I remember that name? And as I did, I went back and I flipped back to try and figure out where I remembered seeing his name. And it's in the first 20 pages of the book, so it had been 500 plus pages. So after the section break, Collins comes back with the beginning of the next section is this. The professor has been so long absent from these pages that he has run some risk of being forgotten altogether. I completely forgot about him. But Collins knows that. And he says, hey, you probably forgot about him. I know, it's okay, because he's so long been absent from these pages, it's okay that you forgot about him. And it's kind of like he's talking directly to the reader and saying, hey, I get it. It's cool. I know. I'm bringing out a character you haven't seen in a while. I know. And one of the things that was made such a big point in the Murder by Death movie is the main character who calls all of these fictional detectives to his house. He challenges them to a contest, basically, for them to solve the mystery. And at the end of the movie, he basically just completely tears into these characters. And he yells at them and he says, "You guys have been doing this to readers for decades. You draw us in with the mystery, and then in the last five pages, you throw out a character that we've never seen before, and you say, this is the guy who did it, and that's end. That's the end of the story. Goodbye." And this character in the movie really criticizes these characters about these subjects, and it's something that I've noticed when I read some of the Agatha Christie books as well. It's really not a fair that the reader doesn't have an equal opportunity to solve the mystery. But Collins is telling you in Woman in White, "I know that you don't remember this guy. It's cool. I get it. I'm not just pulling a guy out of my ass. This is somebody who you haven't seen before. Don't go searching through the last 400 pages to figure out where he's been. He hasn't been there." And he does this again a little bit later, but with some more of the mystery of the Woman in White. Because he's telling the story, Hartwright's telling the story of what happened and how Count Fosco and Percival schemed to fake a death and this and that. And I'm not going to get into too much of it, but basically the relationship, the Woman in White plays a much more active role in the last third of the story because of the way that Count Fosco and Percival utilize her services. But the conclusion of her story is one that if Count Fosco and Percival had done it differently, it could have had some problems. The way that it works out, it worked out well for Percival and Count Fosco. But the question is, well, what would have happened if circumstances had been different? And Wilkie Collins expects that. And I don't want to read it to you because it'll give away what did happen. But he says, well, here's a question, and it's Hartwright reading the story because he's... Oh, actually, this wasn't from Hartwright. Who wrote this? This was as part of Hartwright's narrative. It was Count Fosco's narrative as part of Hartwright. So this is Count Fosco's narrative. And he tells you, this is what happened, and you're now asking the question, what would have happened if this had happened? Well, this is what we would have done. Because I was reading the story, and I thought I'd missed something. I thought that there was a part of the story that I had not focused on when they were describing the events. And I know I'm being really, really vague, and I don't want to reveal it all to you. But when Count Fosco explains what happened, there was an aspect to it which I thought that I had missed. And here at the end of Count Fosco's narrative, he says, "You didn't miss it. If that had happened, this is what we would have done." And I think it's really a prescient focus that Collins had, where he was able to understand that the reader might have a question. It tied it up too neatly. Everything fell into place too well for the bad guys. Well, what if it hadn't fallen into place so well? What would they have done? And instead of the reader just sitting there going, well, either they told me and I missed it, or they're ignoring it and it's just too tidily wrapped up with a nice bow, Colin says, okay, I understand it was too tidily wrapped up, but I'm also going to tell you that I give some thought to the fact that what if it hadn't been? And that's a true testament to really the skill of Wilkie Collins. Now, I've given some thought to why Collins is less well-known than Dickens. And when I started reading this book, my wife actually asked me what I was reading, and I told her, and I said, "Have you ever heard of Wilkie Collins?" And she said, "No, I never heard of him before." I said, "Well, he happens to have been, close friend of Dickens, and they wrote at the same time." She'd never heard of him either, and I think I know why. This is my interpretation. We know that so many of Dickens's novels had a political bent to it, whether it was a castigation of the justice system, castigation of the orphanage system and poverty, whether it was castigation of the money lending, and we certainly know that a lot of Dickens's literature is influenced by his childhood, and a lot of the study of Dickens is the study of his childhood. His dad being in the debtor's prison is something that we all learned, and a lot of Dickens's novels have attributes that are taken directly from his childhood, such as the character who's in the debtor's prison, and the childhood that he wished he'd had, and the hard childhood that he did have, and a lot of the books that involve the young characters like Oliver Twist and David Copperfield, we see that those are, I think, Dickens's ode to childhood and the fact that childhood is really wasted on the young, and his enjoyment of childhood through the eyes of his young characters when he didn't get to enjoy childhood on his own. And so many of Dickens's novels have that political bent to it. Bleak House, Hard Times, Oliver Twist, Our Mutual Friend, they all seem to have, and those are the ones, by the way, that are much more well known. I'm not talking about a Nicholas Nickleby or a Martin Chuzzlewit or even The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which haven't really stood the test of time or were not as well written as some of the other books were, like Bleak House and Oliver Twist and Great Expectations. But so they had that social commentary to it with a political bent to it. And I think that, coupled with Dickens's personal history, really makes Dickens a much more intriguing author to study. On top of that, I think that Dickens's novels, there's more of them that have really stood the test of time as being true classics. I believe that Wilkie Collins wrote something like 25 or 26 books, but other than The Moonstone and The Woman in White, I don't believe that any of them really stood the test of time or are still in print. And I think that may be as well a testament to the fact that perhaps Wilkie Collins' success in writing wasn't as profound as Dickens's was. I think that's a true possibility. Because when was the last time you were in a literature class where you studied a mystery? I mean, it's... people don't think of mysteries as being literature. I remember when I was in 12th grade English, and we were tasked, it was an English literature class, we were tasked with doing a report on an English author, and I seem to recall wanting to do my report on Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and the teacher telling me I couldn't because it wasn't true literature, and those were mysteries. They were throwaway mysteries. I think my brother seems to recall it was a different author than Arthur Conan Doyle, but I still stick with that. But so, you know, you don't study mysteries. And this one, The Woman in White, it's a thriller. It's suspenseful. And you don't study those so much because there's less to study. You can certainly study the structure. You can study the way that it was written. You can study the way it was put together. But the language itself does not lend itself to as much focused studying as a Dickens novel, and it doesn't have as much political bent. Now, The Woman in White certainly had social commentary. It certainly is a feminist type of a book because it does not portray all of the female characters as passive and very defined by their gender roles of the time period. Marion is an incredibly dynamic character. She understands what the gender roles are, but she doesn't want to be restricted to them. And she I think is a good precursor to the feminist movement because of her. Now, she does at times take the back seat and understand what her gender roles are. She is truly a tragic character in this book. Because things don't work out really well for her. She doesn't get what she wants, but in some respects she does get what she wants because she sees the people that she loves get what they want. And that's not a particularly feminist position to be in. I think there's a lot of aspects of the Marion character that can be a good demonstration of the future feminist movement. But anyways, you can tell I truly, truly enjoyed the book. I didn't know what to expect, but I really, really enjoyed it. It was such a wonderful reading experience. It's not one that I think I could duplicate again by reading it again, And look, it's long, it's slow, but if you have the patience for it, it's well worth it. I recommend it much more highly than I recommend the Moonstone. And it's interesting when I mentioned the Moonstone, because a couple weeks ago, Entertainment Weekly, of which I'm a subscriber, came out with this issue of the 100 all-time greatest movies, TV shows, albums, and novels. And of the 100 greatest novels ever, disappointing in my perception, I'd only read 17 of them. Number one, by the way, is Anna Karenina. I've never read that. Number two is The Great Gatsby. Number four, Great Expectations. They have number seven is the Harry Potter series. Number 10, Charlotte's Web novel. I don't know, kids' book. Number 13, To Kill a Mockingbird. 25 was Bleak House. 29 was The Handmaid's Tale, which I just finished. 32, The Catcher in the Rye. 37, Sun Also Rises. You and I, we've already talked about that. Oh, whatever. I won't buy that one at all, but whatever. 59, Dracula. 63, Portnoy's Complaint, which I really enjoyed. 67, Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. Great book. Really enjoyable. 84, Clockers. 85, Catch-22. 88, Bonfire of the Vanities. 97, The Big Sleep. There you go. Raymond Chandler. Big Sleep. I don't remember if that was Sam Spade. I just can't remember. But here we go. Number 94, The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins. And the description is, before there were Patricia Cornwell and Michael Connelly, there was Collins, and this tale of a stolen Indian diamond is one of the first, not to mention the finest detective novels ever written. I guess you can take this list, and you can look at some of the books as being the greatest ever, not because of their story, but because of the influence that they had on later generations of writers. So from that perspective, I guess I would take The Moonstone over The Woman in White. But if I'm going to review these just from the outlook of which one was better, which one was more enjoyable, which one was a more complete novel, The Woman in White, hands down. The Moonstone reads like a detective novel. It really does. It's a slow detective novel. The Woman in White, not like that at all. This one was truly it was an event book. It was an event book. I think that's a good way to describe it. Now, going back to this 100 greatest novels of all time, there's a sidebar, which I was pretty impressed with, which is the 10 greatest mysteries and thrillers. And I was much, much more proud of this list because of the 10, I'd read 5. And of the remaining 5, I'd actually read not those books, but I had read one book by that same author. So the 10 greatest mysteries and thrillers, number one was The Spy Who Came In from the Cold by John le Carré. I didn't read that, but I've read 3 or 4 of his other books, so I guess at some point I'll read that. Although, for whatever reason, the Cold War stuff, the Russians, it just doesn't interest me as much. But number two on this list, The Moonstone. Number three, The Big Sleep. Number seven, the aforementioned Drood by Dan Simmons. How do you like that? I just thought that was interesting. Number eight, The Black Echo by Michael Connelly, the first Harry Bosch novel, still the best. And number 10, Presumed Innocent by Scott Turow. So I've talked about quite a few of those books already in one or numerous of the podcasts. I was proud of that because, as you've probably learned through listening so far, mysteries and thrillers are really my genre of choice. And the fact that I've read 5 of these, The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, I probably will read at some point. One of them, number 4, was The Skull Beneath the Skin by P.D. James. I haven't read any P.D. James. Number 6, A Great Deliverance by Elizabeth George. I actually have an Elizabeth George book. I just haven't read it yet. And number 9, Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, which I've heard is excellent. I probably will get it. I think it's downstairs in the library. I think my wife read it. But yeah, that was the one I was much more proud of. This 17 out of 100, not so much. Although one of them, I've already picked up, two of them. I picked up book number 26, The Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. I picked that up not too long ago. Interestingly enough, number 54, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which was recommended to me by my brother. I've got it on my Kindle. I'm going away next week on vacation. I'm going to have it on my Kindle, so I'm going to read that while I'm away. Right now, just so you know, I'm reading Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn, and I have resisted reading this for a very, very long time. It came out last year. And I listened to a lot of other literary podcasts, and all of the podcasts talked about the book. They didn't reveal any of the secrets, but they all talked about it as being such a magnificent book and this great mystery and this tremendous reveal and twists and all that kind of stuff. And I pretty much have stayed away from it simply because of all the hype. I don't know. I'm not really one anymore for reading books that are event books. I was like that when I was 17 and 18 years old, where I wanted to make sure I was reading all the books that were on the top 10 bestseller list. I'm not like that anymore. But it was recommended to me by somebody else who really enjoyed it and wanted to talk about it. So I'm about 25% of the way through that. And so we'll talk about that next time, I think. Next time we'll also talk about The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, which I just finished, and I really liked it. Strange, odd, not my typical book, but after having read Brave New World, 1984, those dystopian novels, it was recommended to me that I read this one as well, because it also has a dystopian aspect to it, and I'm looking forward to talking about that with you as well. So this is a lengthy discussion of The Woman in White. I cannot tell you enough how much I enjoyed this book. This one makes up for all the crappy books that I've read this year that I've complained to you about. This was the one that is going to be at the top of the list at the end of the year. I guarantee it. So that's it for Book Therapy. Find me on Twitter, BookTherapy13. Find me on Facebook, Facebook.com/BookTherapy. Please go to iTunes and subscribe. I'd love to figure out a way to get this out to more people. And look, if you like it, tell other people about it. I know it's a different subject. You got to really love books. You got to love reading books to want to listen to some of these podcasts. But I know they're out there. I know that there are people out there who love to read as much as I do. So that's it. I'm Rob Cohen. Thanks for letting me lie on your couch.